So we'll be continuing our study in the book of Job, and we are in chapter 20. And to get us started out, I just want to recap some of the things we talked about last week from chapter 19. In chapter 19, we have Job responding to Bildad's second rebuke. Job's focus is on how, well, he's trying to show how he is actually fully considering the consequences of his actions, which is unlike what Bildad accused him of. Bildad had stated things like, he's heading down this path like a blind man about to stumble into these traps. And Job is saying, no, it's not like that at all. And he actually turns it around on Bildad and his other two friends, as Job commonly does, and spend some time talking about how they're the ones who are being set up for judgment because they are falsely accusing him. They're the ones who aren't realizing that there are consequences to their actions in accusing him falsely. And in verses 5 and 6, you see Job refer to this several times throughout this discourse. In verses 5 and 6, Job says, "If indeed you magnify yourselves against me and make my disgrace an argument against me, know then that God has put me in the wrong and has closed his net about me." But this idea that they're making his disgrace an argument against him indicates there is no substance to the things they're accusing him of. They're simply looking at his suffering and they're saying, you must have done something to deserve that. And how extreme your suffering is, therefore how extreme the transgression against God must have been. But they don't have anything really of substance to say, here's what you did wrong. Now, his words, I think, that Job's speaking are contributing to their argument in a way, but they can't go back to some root thing that Job did to bring all this on him, and Job keeps reminding them of that. In chapter 19 and verse 22, we see Job, he equates the misery his friends were causing him with what God was doing to him. In verse 22, he says, "Why do you, like God, pursue me? Why are you not satisfied with my flesh?" So this approach, again, that Job is taking throughout this chapter, warning his friends of judgment and accountability. We talked about how maybe Job is possibly projecting some of his frustrations he feels towards God onto his friends. Because we looked how in chapter 9, Job talks about how there's no one I can bring God into court with to judge over us, right? There's no one basically who can hold God accountable. I can't accuse God and hope that that's going to produce anything. But he can accuse his friends of doing things that are basically like God and remind them there will be accountability and judgment for them. So there could be this idea of Job projecting some of these frustrations about not being able to hold God accountable or bring God into judgment, but he can to his friends. So as part of Job's focus on accountability and judgment, he talks about how he wants these events that have happened to him to be remembered and not soon forgotten, like the man that Bildad talked about in the previous chapter. And we're going to see Zophar go into this again. Really, the main theme of Zophar's response in chapter 20 is the temporary nature of man's success if man tries to go his own way and disregards God, and how God will work that out very quickly against that man. But Job talks here about how he wants these events to be pinned in iron and engraved in rock, are the poetic terms that he uses. And we talked about how ironically they actually were, because here we go, right? We've got the book of Job with us today. So it seems that God granted Job that request. You know, these events were not forgotten. They were things that we're studying even now, you know, thousands of years later, which is kind of interesting to think about. In an indirect sense, we're participating in Job's vindication as we talk about these things, as we look at it from the bigger context. I think that you can look at that and maybe be encouraged and reminded that, you know, if we're facing any injustice, you know, or anything that just isn't fair and we're just having to endure it, if you're in that position, know that that's just a temporary thing, you know, like it was with Job. It was obviously very temporary with him. And we see how the vindication of the righteous from false accusation. We see the protracted amount of time that people have been looking at this book and on into who knows how long, compared to the short amount of time that Job had to deal with this injustice. So know that vindication and having those wrongs righted will be done in an eternal perspective, not like this temporary injustice you may be going through. So hopefully you find some encouragement in that. Before we get into Zophar's, what will be his second and apparently his final response, he doesn't reply a third time like his two friends do. We don't know why exactly, but this will be his final response. But are there any questions or any other comments about chapter 19 that you guys wanted to talk about? Okay, let's get into chapter 20. So, again, to set the stage, Zophar is going to spend some time refuting Job's request for these events to be remembered. That's really going to be his focus. He's going to talk about how the wicked are only going to prosper for a brief moment in time, and then they're punished swiftly by God. And when we get into chapter 21, we're going to see Job refute these points by kind of asking Zophar, you know, prove how God swiftly punishes the wicked. You're going to tell me now that God's going to bring swift judgment upon the wicked. But actually, is that really true? And prove that to me. Because from what Job has seen, sometimes the wicked live a pretty good life. Sometimes they go their entire life without having to experience any of the consequences of the evil things that they've done. And Job's going to point out that these men sometimes even maintain honor after they die. They're continued to be honored and respected after they die. So is it really true what you're saying, Zophar? So those are some of the things we're going to be considering as we look at Zophar's response. And just a side note, if you didn't read ahead, Zophar does seem to like to use bodily functions to prove his point. So be ready for that. It keeps going back to it. So verses 1 through 3 in Job chapter 20. Then Zophar the Naamathite answered and said, "Therefore my thoughts answer me because of my haste within me. I hear censure that insults me, and out of my understanding a spirit answers me." So very simply, no one likes being called stupid. I think that's the main thing that Zophar is trying to say here. He feels the need again to defend his wisdom and understanding based on some of the sharp insults that Job has sent in the direction of his friends. And I think this idea in verse 2, when he says, "My thoughts answer me because of the haste within me," I think the meaning is something like, my thoughts need to be spoken quickly to try to snuff out this nonsense. I think that's the general idea of what he's trying to say. But some of these things, because of how they're phrased, and again, you'll look at different translations and you'll see, different renderings of these passages. You know, I'm open to hearing your thoughts on them as well. But that's kind of what I think it's saying. So verses 4 and 5, Zophar continues, "Do you not know this from of old, since man was placed on earth, that the exalting of the wicked is short, and the joy of the godless, but for a moment?" So here's his main argument that he's going to build on now. It's like he's saying, you know, Job, you said you wanted the events of your life to be pinned in iron and engraved in rock. No, it's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. That's not how it works. And here's why. So verses 6 through 11. Zophar says, "Though his height mount up to the heavens and his head reach to the clouds, he will perish forever like his own dung. Those who have seen him will say, 'Where is he?' He will fly away like a dream and not be found. He will be chased away like a vision of the night. The eye that saw him will see him no more, nor will his place any more behold him. His children will seek the favor of the poor, and his hands will give back his wealth. His bones are full of his youthful vigor, but it will lie down with him in the dust." So Zophar is again using these poetic images to talk about how a wicked man's not going to be remembered. And in verse 6, when he says, "though his height mount up to the heavens and his head reach to the clouds," I think what he's talking about there is in reference to a man's accomplishments. As great as a man may do or be in this life, here's what's going to happen to him if he's wicked. In fact, in verse 7, he's actually going to be buried unceremoniously like a man buries his own feces, is the very lovely image that we have there. In verse 10, his children will seek the favor of the poor, and his hands will give back his wealth. The idea there that he's not going to have anything to leave his children, and they are going to be so poor, hyperbole is, they'll be so poor that they're going to ask the poor for help. They're going to be asking the poor to give to them. And this is something that Job is actually going to address directly in chapter 21 when we get there. And he's going to look at it kind of ironically as saying, why would the wicked man care about his children after he dies? He's wicked. What does he care what happens to his kids? Right? If he's completely selfish and worried only about himself, why is he going to care about that? And I think that Job's going to do some of this to try to point out the incoherence of Zophar's argument. And I think it's not supposed to be lost on the reader that Zophar's argument is not very good. Some of the things he said may resonate a little bit when you read it the first time through, but there's some problems with it, and Job's going to jump all over it in chapter 21. So Job's basically saying, yeah, if I'm wicked, I don't care what happens to my children after I die. And in fact, Job's going to say the children of the wicked do prosper sometimes. You're wrong about that. I don't see in every case the children of the wicked begging from the people who are poor. That's just not what I've experienced. And, you know, not to mention on top of this that let's remind ourselves that Job's children are dead. Right? So how exactly does this apply? You know, and you start to see some of the incoherence. You see, and this happens sometimes. I've been there, I think. I'm trying to give Zophar a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. I've been there where I've got this idea in my head, and I'm on this track, and I'm just going down this track, and I kind of lose sight of the big picture. And I think that's some of what you're seeing in Zophar's argument here. So let's understand that this isn't the kind of chapter we ought to open our Bibles to without any context and pick things out of and start using them in our arguments. That's all I'm trying to say. Back in verse 11, he says, his bones are full of his youthful vigor, but it will lie down with him in the dust. Again, a poetic way of saying that the wicked man's going to die in the time of what is supposed to be his prime, and all of his vigor, his energy, his strength, his potential is going to be buried with him, and it will be unfulfilled. That's the idea there. Any other comments or questions to this point? Yeah, Sean. Right.
And he's just off. It's kind of terrifying.
Yeah. Have you ever been in a situation where you've been so frustrated with somebody that all of the context of your relationship with that person gets like put on a shelf and they just become this purveyor of some viewpoint, and your attack of them is focused on the viewpoint, but you really start attacking them and you start confusing the individual for the viewpoint? I don't know, if you've ever been there, I think you'll know what I'm talking about. I've been there, unfortunately, and I think I've seen that happen sometimes with people. Let's not throw out the entire context of what we know about this individual whenever some conflict happens. Yeah, John, you had your hand up?
Far from it, but it just seems like Zophar is overly
Yeah, I think that, at least for me, I think you can kind of see a little bit of difference between their personalities coming out and how they're approaching the situation. They all say some things that are pretty shocking, but when they're coming at you with such a barrage, it kind of gets just lost. Like the shock value is lost because there's so much of it coming, you know? But I tend to agree. You know, I think that Eliphaz seems very focused in what he's saying, and maybe a little more tactful, especially at first. He's a lot more tactful at first. Zophar seems to demonstrate the least amount of control and mastery over what he's trying to say, in my opinion. But that's just my opinion. And then Bildad's got his own little quirks. I don't know how. I probably haven't spent a whole lot of time trying to break down the differences between them. But I think, as far as a progression goes, you know, the content's driving the progression, I think. And I think you're seeing frustration starting to mount. And, you know, that typically is not a good thing. It doesn't help the matter be more well understood. It just gets tempers going, and people are saying things now that I think what we're reading here with Zophar is not really even coherent in some ways. He's just on this line of thought. He's upset. He's going down it, and he's just saying, "Job, this is you." And really, there isn't a lot of substance to it at all. Yeah, Rod?
We're going to see later when Elihu finally speaks up, who's the youngest. He's frustrated with some of what his colleagues have said here. Too. So I think his personalities, it might be age. Maybe Eliphaz spoke first because he's the oldest of the three. We don't know. We're not giving that information. But I mean, we do it too. If we're in a group, we don't argue the same way. You wouldn't bring up the same exact points that I would, or in the same way. I might be more forceful. You might be more compassionate, trying to say the same thing, but we say it with our own style.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
In your face.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's pretty in your face. I think that's a good way of putting it. And you know, to your point, you know, Elihu's specifically frustrated because it's apparent to him that they have nothing on Job. You know, he's upset because he's not too happy with Job saying either, but he's upset with Job's friends because they haven't been able to answer Job, right? So Elihu sees the shortcomings in these arguments they're putting out. Anything else before we get into the next section? All right, so verses 12 through 21. Let's go ahead and read through this, and then I want to talk through, since the theme of this chapter for me has kind of become how to not argue well, I want to try to look at, you know, here's another logical fallacy I think that Zophar is using, and I want to make sure we understand what that logical fallacy is so that we don't use it inadvertently. So verses 12 through 21, Zophar argues, "Though evil is sweet in his mouth, though he hides it under his tongue, though he is loath to let it go and holds it in his mouth, yet his food is turned in his stomach. It is the venom of cobras within him. He swallows down riches and vomits them up again. God casts them out of his belly. He will suck the poison of cobras. The tongue of a viper will kill him. He will not look upon the rivers, the streams flowing with honey and curds. He will give back the fruit of his toil and will not swallow it down. From the profit of his trading he will get no enjoyment. For he has crushed and abandoned the poor. He has seized a house that he did not build. Because he knew no contentment in his belly, he will not let anything in him which he delights escape him. There was nothing left after he had eaten. Therefore, his prosperity will not endure." So here we have Zophar giving this image of a man who apparently has, for some reason, decided to ingest cobra venom. Maybe he didn't realize he was doing that. But he's using this as an analogy for how God is going to deal with the wicked person. So to the man in the analogy, he's swallowing riches. And I think the image there is this man who is taking advantage of others so that he can collect riches to himself, but he does not realize the mortal nature of these things that he's collecting. They're going to end up being the end of him. and that these delicacies that he's consuming figuratively are actually more like cobra venom. And then this venom, just as cobra venom would be quick to take its effect on the body, according to Zophar, inducing vomiting, so God is quickly going to require back those things that temporarily belong to the evil man. He's not going to be able to keep them like a man would be able to hold his food in, okay? So the problem, there are some problems with this analogy, and again, Job's going to point out some of this in the next chapter, but first and foremost, it doesn't always turn out this way for the wicked man. According to Job's experience, sometimes the wicked prosper and they live a full life. And it's not immediately required back from them all the evil things that they've done. And the analogy doesn't work in every case. Well, and because in every case where a man might actually happen to ingest venom like this, he may experience those near immediate effects, but it's not necessarily the case with the wicked man. So let's talk about this logical fallacy. And I want to make sure we understand this, but at the same time, I hope we don't beat it to death. So if you start saying I'm beat it to death, just raise your hand and tell me, okay? But I think what we are seeing here is Zophar using a logical fallacy called argument from analogy. And I don't know if you've ever heard of this before, but I wanted to spend a few moments just identifying what this type of argument looks like so we don't use it when we're trying to make a point. So does anybody understand what that is, if you've heard that phrase before? And can you, does anyone know what that means, argument from analogy? So in logic, there are formalized fallacies, and you can just search online and you can find a list, any number from a dozen to several hundred, depending on how narrow people want to get, as far as identifying ways we often think when we're trying to make a point, but we shouldn't, if you will. So I think a good definition of an argument by analogy is an argument that employs an analogy as its premise. So the problem is that the truth of the point or the argument that is being made depends on the truth of the analogy. And that's a problem, okay? Just because things may happen in an analogy and what the analogy presents may be true does not prove that the argument is true. You with me so far on that? Does that make sense? So in Zophar's case, he's arguing that just as a man quickly vomits after venom has been ingested, so does God quickly require back from that man the good things that he tried to fill himself with. So when you look at the analogy, it is true, or it's at least plausible, that a man who ingests venom is going to quickly vomit it up. The truth is there in the analogy, but the fact that that's going to happen in the analogy does not prove the point that Zophar is trying to make. You can't say because this happens when a man ingests cobra venom that that's how God's going to treat people who are wicked. It doesn't prove the point, right? So that's okay. You can use an analogy if you're not depending on it to prove your point, but you need to have some substance to your argument other than just the thrust of your analogy. It has to be stronger than just, well, look at the cobra and look at the guy who ate the poison. See what happened to him? That's like you. Well, not exactly, right? So, I don't want to beat this to death, but I did want to look at a couple of other analogies that can be used properly and improperly because, again, let's try to make this practical and let's make sure we're checking ourselves before we use something like this by mistake. So, when we think of analogies that are used properly, something that comes to my mind are like the parables that Jesus spoke. So he's packaging, when Jesus spoke these parables, he's packaging these spiritual principles and truths into these hypothetical events and scenarios so that his audience can easily relate to them. And in some cases, he's trying to make the spiritual concepts easier to understand, and I think in some cases, actually, he's trying to conceal the meaning, depending on the person's reaction. It's even stated like if the person doesn't want to put in the effort to understand this, then they're not going to. They're going to just, what is he talking about, and then walk away. But none of these parables, you can go and read through some of them, are employing an analogy as a premise. They don't depend upon the truth of the events in the analogy in order to be valid. Okay, and just for one example, I think about the parable of the sower in Matthew chapter 13, and I want to talk about how we can get off track if we start trying to use argument by analogy. So in the parable of the sower, you have the seed that represents the word, right? You've got the soil that represents man's reaction to it, or his heart, if you will. And you've got these things representing these spiritual truths that Jesus was trying to convey, but the analogy wouldn't work if you try to just plug those truths into the context of the analogy. And I'm starting to use a lot of words, but stick with me. If you try to look at it this way, you're going to reach some wrong or maybe irrelevant conclusions. Like, just if you think about just the analogy and how everything tries to fit together perfectly, you may come away with from the parable of the sower thinking like, well, you know, the sower doesn't seem to care much about which ground he sows on, so God must not care much about how the word is sent out, right? Because in your mind, you're in the context of the analogy. Or the soil isn't able to change itself, right? How can a soil pluck its own rocks out, or how can it remove its own weeds? So a man is not able to truly change his nature or his reaction to the gospel. You know, or, you know, we see how the birds, they pick away the soil from the wayside, and that's gone immediately. But you don't see them doing that in the rocky soil or the thorny soil. So, you know, maybe there's no hope for the person who initially rejects the word, but there is for these other types of hearts. And you can start getting lost in a maze of your own trying to interpret this because you're stuck too much into the analogy and trying to make everything fit together in the analogy. And on it can go. So I think that that's a little bit of what Zophar is stuck on in his analogy that he's using that we just read through about this man who's ingesting poison. The point of a parable or an analogy is not to try to have a perfectly coherent image of how all the pieces fit together in the parable and then flip it over into a spiritual truth. Okay, so just again, Jesus' points in his parables didn't depend on the coherence of his analogy, but his analogy was only relevant in as far as it represented the spiritual truths he was trying to convey. Okay, we understand there is a spiritual truth. Jesus is using this analogy to try to help us understand it, and we shouldn't get lost in the details of the analogy. Does that kind of make sense? No one's saying no, so I assume you've all got it. That's fantastic.
Forrest Gump said life is like a box of chocolates. You're saying that doesn't prove anything, but some people leave it there and say, well, it must prove something because somebody said it, and Zophar said something. Well, so what? He said it.
It's funny because life is like a box of chocolates is one that I went to immediately in my thoughts. I didn't include it in my outline, but I was like, eh, people in Forrest Gump, you know. But yes, no, I think that, you know, the point of that analogy, life is like a box of chocolates, isn't to prove that by having a box of chocolates you can understand life. Right? It's to say that there are things in life that happen that can be represented by these different chocolates. You bite into it, you don't know what it's going to be. Right? So there's kind of a subtle line to walk here. You know, you want to use analogies to make your arguments clearer, but you don't want your arguments to have to depend on the analogy in order to have weight. Yes. Right.
And it actually could be totally off, and they just hold on to that. So it's a very humbling kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Very well said. And I think that's a good way of summarizing what I'm trying to say. We don't want to get too witty. We don't want to try to put together this beautiful analogy and then say, oh, but this can fit here, and oh, look, this can fit in here, and this can fit in here, like the fishing lure and the depth of it. Eventually, you're creating truths because your analogy makes you do that. Right, you're understanding truth through a lens of fishing at that point, and you know that would be argument from analogy. Very
which
good point.
Is funny too, because none of those guys use lures, which was also the comical part about that they just threw a net in. So you're also right. Sitting there like, oh, now this is bad.
Right. Right. Yeah, Billy?
Well, and to piggyback on, I mean, the big picture here is just the humility that we should be picking up from all of them, including Job. You really have a complicated situation, and the only one who knows what's actually going on is God. And all of these men are talking, and so what they're saying is true, and so what they're saying is stupid. So what they're saying is wrong, but you understand how they think it. And, you know, if you kind of look at this whole thing, big picture, God is in control. He's the only one that knows totally what's going on. And we need to be really careful about what we say and what we think and what we tell other people as a rule. All of us, as we get older, look back on things we said to people in the past and cringe at the utter foolishness that we have put on somebody else's back, you know, because we didn't have the wisdom, and that's just part of life. You have the wisdom to keep your mouth shut, and you know, and so that's what I'm seeing a lot here. I'm sometimes more a big picture person. Looking at all of this, and you just realize how messy life is. We're all looking for these answers that we can just apply 100% of the time, and sometimes that's not available because situations are in flux and different things are happening. And like you said, you know, looking at people and basically boiling them down to, well, that's a guy who blah blah blah, and that's all they are. And in reality, when God's looking at that person, that's a complex person with a complex set of circumstances. It doesn't mean that God doesn't have a law. It doesn't mean that God doesn't have some absolutes. I'm not saying that, but we oftentimes are putting ourselves in positions that we are not qualified to be putting ourselves into.
Yeah. Yeah, excellent thoughts. And, you know, I mean, to that point, humility is not something that comes naturally. You know, like any other spiritual virtue, it takes focused effort. You're not just going to stumble into humility or make a decision and know that you're a humble person. And unfortunately, that humility, I think, can be attained by the types of, you know, experiences you've talked about where you have said something or argued something that now you're like, oh, can't believe I did that, you know. We can not only defend God's truth properly while remaining humble, I think it's necessary for us to do that. And what are we doing to focus on humility? You know, how are we trying to ensure that we are being humble? And let's not just brush past it and take it for granted. I think that, again, we talked about this, I think, several weeks ago, but this idea of how we can kind of just assume that we love this person that we're disagreeing with, or we can just assume we are being humble, but we're not really focused on how we're demonstrating those traits. So let's check ourselves every step of the way whenever there's a disagreement. Yeah, David? Yeah.
It's a stream of thought of God's going to repay this is right. His application of where and how.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe the first problem here, like we've talked about, is Zophar doesn't know how Job brought this on himself. And he suspects and he's convinced that he did something. And he needs to repent of whatever it was. But, you know, let's learn from this. You know, if even in a zeal to defend God, You know, let's be careful how we treat each other. And Job calls them out on that. He says, you know, you show partiality to God. Do you think God doesn't know that? And that he's not going to hold you accountable for that? Yeah, I understand there's a zeal to defend God, but, you know, let's be honest and let's be careful and humble and not saying that it, by any means that we use those as an excuse to not act, right? I think we all know what we're talking about here. So, again, just trying to tie this up. You know, I think that Zophar is using this type of argumentation. He's understanding truths through the analogy or through the picture he's creating, and he's backfilling these truths into the context of his analogy. We need to be careful that we don't do that in our argumentation. We need to be careful that we don't latch on to people who have done that and filter our understanding of the Bible and truths through these maxims that we've heard that sounded so clever. One example of which is, this idea that whether or not a person is a false teacher, if they teach something wrong by mistake, I've heard the analogy used, well, if someone ingests poison, the damage is done, whether they believe they were taking medicine or poison. And you start to understand how you should act and understand that situation through the analogy, because it's like, oh yeah, if a person does take poison, whether they meant to or not, then they're dead, right? And you don't really, or the risk is that you don't dig any deeper than that. But the Bible has a lot to say about that topic, you know, that really has nothing to do with the analogy. And I think the analogy is at best irrelevant. Right? We can go to Acts chapter 18 and see how did they treat Apollos when Apollos taught something wrong, right? And do we know for sure that if something's taught incorrectly that the damage is irreparable? I don't know that that's true. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be careful about what we teach, because the Bible clearly teaches that too. It says, let not many of you become teachers. There's a solemn warning there, and we need to take that charge very, very seriously. But we also can't lay on ourselves as teachers the burden of saying everything perfectly. And if we think that we have to carry that burden, I think the natural reaction is going to be, I'm going to become less willing to hear what other people have to say if it differs from what I said. Because if you tell me that I taught something wrong, now I have to think about my accountability of having sent poison out to all these other people, right? I've effectively killed all these people if I'm wrong. So I'm going to resist the reality that I'm wrong for as long as I can. I shouldn't. But that can be the way that we can go with that. So we can get off track when we start thinking of spiritual truths in terms of these analogies that we come up with that seem really clever on the surface. So let's just be careful before we use them. That's really all I want to take away from that. Again, just to finish out the chapter, verses 20 through 21, we looked at it already, but he says, because he knew no contentment in his belly, he will not let anything in which he delights escape him. There was nothing left after he had eaten. Therefore, his prosperity will not endure. So the ESV renders this a little bit differently than some other translations do. And the idea behind the ESV is this man who basically took everything for himself, and he should have left something for other people, but he was so greedy, he didn't leave anything for them. And that fits. That could be correct. But there's other translations that render it something more like the idea that man will have no fulfillment from the things that he served himself. And that's really more of the idea. Not that he took too much and didn't leave anything for anybody else, but that the things that he took will not give him any fulfillment. So look at different translations on that and come to your own conclusion on that. I think both of them kind of fit what's being talked here, but perhaps the idea that the man's not going to have any fulfillment from the things he served himself is more in line with what the context is talking about here. So verse 23, to fill his belly to the full, God will send his burning anger against him and rain it upon him into his body. He will flee from an iron weapon. His bronze arrow will strike him through. The idea here that the tragedy is going to strike him suddenly when he's least expecting it. And while he's yet to about to feed himself more, he's going to have this removed from him. So he will flee from an iron weapon. A bronze arrow will strike him through. It is drawn forth and comes out of his body. The glittering point comes out of his gallbladder. Terrors come upon him. Utter darkness is laid up for his treasures. A fire not fanned will devour him. What is left in his tent will be consumed. The heavens will reveal his iniquity, and the earth will rise up against him. The possessions of his house will be carried away, dragged off in the day of God's wrath. This is the wicked man's portion from God, the heritage decreed for him by God. So verses 24 through 29, just going into a lot of poetic detail about the tragedy that's going to befall the wicked man and how terrible it's going to be for him. Verse 27, when it says, the heavens will reveal his iniquity and the earth will rise up against him. I think the idea here is just how much of a spectacle this will be. It will be so obvious that the heavens and the earth will see it and know it. There's nothing that exists that won't know what happened to this man. So it will not only be tragic, it will also be very public and shameful. So that's Job chapter 20. We're a couple minutes over time, so I'll end the class. But thank you for your comments and questions.